From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, tough times in Benton Harbor, and it's about to get even tougher. Plus, what's behind the soaring numbers of Chinese students on college campuses in Michigan?
There's a lot of Chinese universities, and they're growing rapidly. But there's really only 40 top-tier, what they call key universities in China.
And Rolling Stone journalist Mark Benelli comes home to write about Detroit.
You know, I wanted to sort of present the sort of spectrum of Detroit. It's not just the Detroit that people often see.
And we will meet the lady who loves, really loves, log cabins.
It's a place where you can, you just feel transported to a different world.
Those stories and much, much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thousands and thousands of international students come to our state each year for a university degree. We'll look at how they're changing the face of education in our state. And Mark Benelli, author of the new book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, will stop by. But first, there's been a burst of headlines coming out of Lansing today concerning State Supreme Court Justice Diane Hathaway. She has reportedly been under FBI investigation over some questionable real estate deals. Michigan Public Radio Network Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta joins us now. Rick, what can you tell us?
Well, what we know is that people inside the Michigan Hall of Justice, that's where the Supreme Court is located, their chambers and the justices' Lansing offices are, that have told me that Justice Hathaway's office has been cleared out, that she's cleared out the locker where she keeps her robe that you wear for hearings. We should say that Justice Hathaway has sent out an email saying that she is not leaving, she is not resigning. Her attorney has said that she is not quitting, and her senior law clerk is also saying that Justice Hathaway is not resigning. But there are people inside the Hall of Justice who say that her office has been cleared of her personal effects.
Have you been able to get any closer to that? Have you been able to get a look at the office?
I mean, clearly the easiest way to settle the question once and for all would just to look in the office and see if there are personal effects there, family pictures, the usual things that you see. I was told that I would have to get permission from Justice Hathaway. I called her law clerk, I called her office, and was told simply, your questions have been answered.
That's it.
That's
so
it.
They wouldn't let you in to take a look.
No.
Listen, what if anything is known about this reported FBI probe?
Well, I mean, not a lot. It will stun you it'll be revealed right here that the FBI typically does not talk about its investigations.
Right.
But there was a Channel 7 report that found documents that suggested that Justice Hathaway, who has a real estate license, may have done some property swaps with her children in order to facilitate short sales before then, taking, reclaiming the property as hers.
I see.
And so that's that's what the investigation, if there is one, that's reportedly what the investigation is about.
So those documents pointed to kind of a shell game to get her out from under a house that was underwater?
Yes. Yes. Very, very expensive houses, not just her residence, but homes in Florida and another one back here in Michigan. And so basically, the way the scheme was outlined, it was turning the property over to someone who has a much lower family income in order to qualify for a short sale, and then after the short sale, she would reclaim the property. And so that's the allegation, we should point out. It is just an allegation.
And, of course, even though feds are investigating, it does not mean charges are imminent.
Nope, that we have not heard of any charge, any actual criminal charges being filed.
Rick, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. From Lansing now to Benton Harbor. These are challenging times for that city and for its emergency financial manager, Joe Harris, trying to pick up the pieces after voters in Michigan rejected the emergency manager referendum And after Benton Harbor, voters rejected not one, but two millage renewals. Harris held a press conference yesterday to spell out the struggling city's shrinking options. Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith covers West Michigan. She joins us now with more. Lindsay, this was the first time since March that emergency financial manager Joe Harris held a news conference. What did he have to say?
Well, he laid out four options for the city. I mean, he's saying this is really a dire condition where you have a 20% loss in revenue in 1 year. It's about $1 million that they'll lose this year, beginning this year right now. So that's a pretty big chunk of the budget. And he's laid out four options. He can try to get this renewal. Well, it won't be a renewal anymore, but try to get the millage back before voters to have them vote on it again. He could create a special assessment district, which is like they kind of do these for sidewalks sometimes. Cities will create a district and charge a fee for a specific service. Now, that is something the Treasury Department says Joe Harris can do on his own, so he wouldn't need permission from City Commission to do that.
Mm-hmm.
He also may get rid of the police department altogether and just contract out with the Berrien County Sheriff, which is similar to what the City of Pontiac did recently.
Yes.
And the fourth option is the most dire bankruptcy, Chapter 9 bankruptcy. He could ask the state to allow the city to declare bankruptcy. Now, that's something that the state has really not seen as a favorable option. So I doubt that that would happen, but he threw it out there. So,
but it wasn't the whole point of having, it had been an emergency manager. Now it's reverted to emergency financial manager. Wasn't the whole point of that to keep cities from going into bankruptcy?
Right, right.
And what are the people and the officials in Benton Harbor feeling about Joe Harris these days?
Well, you know, it's not been a very healthy relationship, I would say, with Joe Harris and many people that used to be supporters at one point of him or at least open to him. I would say within the last 8 months, things have really deteriorated there. As far as relationships, there have been kind of closed door meetings with elected city officials in the state and corporate leaders in the state. So there is some certainly lots of people behind the scenes that are not happy with Harris, who used to be at one point or at least gave him a shot. Last night when the mayor, James Hightower, wasn't allowed into the meeting or into this press conference, you know, he was really disappointed. And later on at the city commission meeting, he introduced a resolution to demand that the Treasury have direct involvement. He's saying this is above Joe Harris. And Joe mm-hmm. Harris has talked about how he thinks he's out the door. And he just says, look, this guy doesn't live here. He could leave us with this mess. So he had this to say last night.
Mr. Harris is the face of Public Act 4. He has gone as far as he should go in this whole ordeal. We are at a point now where the Treasury Department needs to own that. They can't let us fail. And I'm hoping that they will not.
So I'm getting the sense, knowing that Mayor Hightower had been supportive and I guess trying to been helpful to Joe Harris, that it sounds like things are just running down the drain between them and as far as the sense of any kind of cooperation.
Yeah, it's a big issue, and especially if you talk about things long term. I mean, this is sort of an immediate crisis that they need to figure out what to do with. And Joe Harris says that he's going to make this decision by the end of the week. He will not be asking for city commission input on that. So there is sort of this immediate thing going on. But, you know, yeah, long term, how eventually will city commission get control and be able to have sort of a smooth transition? I mean, that's going to take cooperation on everybody's part. And this has been a real problem, certainly within the last 6 to 8 months.
Lindsay, are you hearing reasons why voters rejected the millage, knowing that the fate of the police department was at stake here?
It wasn't framed that way when the election happened. It wasn't, if you don't pass this, this is what's going to happen. So it's being framed like that now, but I'm not sure voters were necessarily so clear what would happen if it did fail. This was supposed to go on the November election in 2011. This millage was supposed to be renewed, and the ball was dropped. Somebody messed up. Joe Harris says it wasn't him, that it was the city assessor at the time who was supposed to put this on the ballot back then, but it didn't get on the ballot. And so the city's already been losing money. So there's been a lot of people for that reason who say, look, Joe Harris messed up and I'm voting against it for that reason. You know, that may have something to do with them just not liking Joe Harris. But I would also say, you know, Bent Harbor is the poorest city in the state of Michigan, and their water bills have increased tremendously. And although this was a millage renewal, I think some people still consider that, you know, if you get rid of it, if you reject it, then your property taxes will be lower. You know, it may have something to do with that, too.
What comes next?
So Joe Harris says he wants to have a decision made by the end of this week, certainly no later than the beginning of next week, because if some of these actions are going to be they're going to need to happen soon. So he's going to run up against some deadlines really quick if he wants to take, you know, the special assessment option, or if he's going to put the renewal or the millage back on the ballot again. He's going to have to really get some things going quickly.
And overall, it one can kind of see perhaps why people in Benton Harbor have dropped their support for Joe Harris. And you kind of have to ask the bigger question, is that whole emergency manager position, was it as helpful as it was supposed to be?
It's a tough call. I think you're right in that, you know, in this community, there is a lot. I guess what I take away from the emergency manager law in this situation in particular is every community is different. A lot of communities that are under emergency financial managers have a lot of the same problems, but every community is different and every emergency financial manager is different. So you have different personalities, and some people are better at working with other people and some people are not. You know, that's nothing, you know, that I'm personally saying against Joe Harris. I'm just saying that these are personality types, you know, and Benton Harbor is not a very large community. It's 10,000 people. So everybody knows everybody. And you have a lot of history in a lot of these communities, and it can be hard to have someone come in from outside. I mean, it can be a good thing and a bad thing that to come in and be able to really do what needs to be done to get the finances back in order.
Thanks, Lindsay.
No, thank you.
Michigan Radio's Lindsay Smith is our West Michigan reporter. Still to come, did you know there was a Log Cabin Society of Michigan? Yeah, we didn't either, until now. We'll speak with the woman who runs it, coming up in 15 minutes, here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The connections between the United States and China have deepened with each passing year. Certainly, trade and economic ties are strong. But there is another way these two countries are becoming more and more linked. Our schools are educating more and more of China's young people. The University of Michigan and Michigan State University are among the top 10 universities in the nation for international student enrollment. And a substantial number of those students are coming from China. In fact, there's been a 23% increase in Chinese students coming to U.S. universities in the past year alone. How is this impacting all sides? The Chinese students, American students, and the universities. What are the benefits and what are the challenges? Peter Briggs directs MSU's Office of International Students and Scholars. And Jing Chui of China is an undergrad student at MSU studying supply chain management. Peter, I'd like to start with you. Why are we seeing such an increase in international students coming to the U.S.? When did these numbers start to rise?
First of all, the U.S. has the best higher education system in the country, so it's a very attractive place. And the number of Chinese students who are coming out of high school, there's just not enough seats in Chinese universities. So there's a couple of things. The real increase started in 2005 and 2006. And I think it's also a strong reflection of the Chinese middle class. They have the ability to pay in ways that they maybe didn't have a generation ago.
So it opens doors that had not been opened just a few short years ago.
Yeah, and I think there's also a liberalization of U.S. visa policy to allow Chinese students to come here, whereas before I think it was very hard to get a U.S. visa. And so you put all these factors together, then you see this very quick rise across a lot of U.S. universities in Chinese undergraduates.
Is there pressure from Chinese parents to get their children into an American school?
Yeah, of course. One of the storylines that I keep hearing is the anxiety of the Chinese middle class. They've got one child, they've got two sets of grandparents, you've got six people overseeing the stewardship of somebody, and education is the best thing and most important thing you can do for them. So they will go to somebody who might know more than they do about getting into a U.S. university. And these are agents, and they play a big role in how decisions are made by where they're going to go to school.
Jing, how did you come to study at Michigan State?
At the beginning, I actually went through the agents as well. I took the college entrance examination in China, and I was not very satisfied with the grade. But I still went to a university in China, and I just want to get experience over there. Meanwhile, I was preparing for coming to the U.S. And the agents helped me a lot, including applying for the schools and the preparation for coming here to the U.S. I applied for six universities in the U.S., and Michigan State was the first one to accept me, and I just went ahead and accepted the offer from Michigan State. At the same time, I was like, if I don't like Michigan State, I can always transfer out to other universities, but I ended up really like the school, and I got very involved on campus, so I decided to stay and just finish my undergrad here.
So, Peter, when you look at the pool of schools that are available for these students in China, how competitive are they?
Well, there's a lot of Chinese universities, and they're growing rapidly, but there's really only 40 about top-tier, what they call key universities in China. And so in terms of high status or high quality, my understanding is about 18% of high school graduates in China can go to Chinese universities, and then among those, everybody really aspires to go to one of these top 40 key universities. And beyond that, then it would be much higher status, I think, or even higher quality to go to Canada, Britain, U.S., New Zealand. There's a lot of other places where they're looking. The exportation of Chinese undergraduates is now becoming kind of a worldwide phenomenon.
And those agents who are based in China are extremely important, aren't they, to helping these families navigate the whole application process? So it's quite a big business.
Yeah. I mean, they certainly want to help the families make good decisions for their future. And these agents are kind of play a brokering role that way.
Jing, when you talked about your year in a college in China before coming to Michigan State, give us an idea of how different it was in a classroom and interacting with your professors there versus what you do at Michigan State.
The Chinese college, during the classes, it's kind of like the students cannot really challenge the authority or the professionalism of the professors. So it's barely there's any communication going on. And when you go to the class, it's like one professor facing hundreds of students. So the communication is really hard, and it takes the office hour. I don't think the office hour actually works out very well because the professor has too many students, and there are too many good students, so they always go ask questions. If you have a simple question, there's no TA or there's no extra help you can get. So that makes the classes harder. The educational system is very different compared to the U.S. to China. In China, we only have one exam, which is the final exam per semester for each class. But here, you have multiple exams and the finals, and you have quiz, and you have lab report to write. So that's very different, and it makes the courses a little bit harder. But I feel like I learned much more than when I was in China if I've taken the same classes.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Peter Briggs, director of Michigan State University's Office of International Students and Scholars, and MSU undergrad student Jing Chui, who is here from China looking at the impact of international students at U.S. schools. Peter, we saw a study that the Journal of International and Intercultural Communication put out that suggests many international students are kind of disappointed in their relationships with American students, and it's the students from China and East Asia that are most likely to be unhappy. What problems do you see as you try to help interaction between the American and the Chinese students?
It is a challenge, and I think the expectation when you dream about coming to another country is that you're going to make friends and all the idealism, and the reality is in lots of other countries where there's lots of international students is
life goes on here. And there are a number of people who are very interested in international students, and there's a lot of others who are, this is their home culture, and they're just not as interested. And you see a lot of studies about what are the interests of the American students, and interest in other cultures is not in the top five. So that's a challenge. I heard in PR interview about Newsweek magazine a couple weeks ago, where they're losing their print journalism, and they said that their sales would go down 30% if they had a foreign person on the cover. And I thought, wow, what kind of factoid is that that talks about our own insularity or our own parochialism? But everybody brings this, and so the term glocal, merging global and local, is our challenge. But it is our challenge to do as deep a job as we can to connect U.S. students and international students together for the purpose of friendship and learning together.
Peter, what benefits do you see the university receiving? There was obviously a decision made to open up to international students. You have a very international flavor to the student body now. So how has the university benefited from that?
I think it was just 6 years ago. I think MSU had 9% out-of-state students, and our provost would call this just an extended Michigan high school. And he said that not tongue-in-cheek at all, but the idea of having diversity from around the country and around the world helps our Michigan students understand better other places. And certainly that's true with international students, where friendship with an international student can be transformational. And we really want that to happen. And as an international educator, that's our goal, is to help facilitate these kind of contacts so that does happen.
I think one has to ask the question, what does the school say to a parent from, say, Traverse City, whose kid did not get into MSU and who feels that their child's place is being taken by the international student?
Well, I think I don't know what their level of competitiveness would be, but the standard for MSU's undergraduate education over the last number of years is much stronger. And so I think it is an issue that the competition to be part of MSU is very strong. That's really a good thing for this university. I think if they're feeling that there isn't a quid pro quo on terms of Chinese students or other students taking seats, but I think there is a strong level of competition, and we think it makes MSU and the state of Michigan better.
In general, what do you think, Peter, the American-educated students like Jinghua, how will they impact future relations between our two countries?
Well, that's one of the ideals of international exchange, is you hope that they have lifelong memories here, not only in Michigan but in the United States. And so as they've learned our language, they've learned our ways, we hope that we've learned from them during the time that they're here, and that in this age of globalization, where people are going to have lots of choices working worldwide, and we want to have an open-minded attitude for how we connect in the world. So we hope that the relationship, or at least the memories, are really a part of your life journey.
Jing, what are your plans? You have how much longer to go, and then what?
I'm graduating December the 15th, and after that, my mom is coming, so I'm taking her to the East Coast and travel, and I probably will start to work in Memphis, Tennessee from January.
So your plan is to stay in the United States?
Yep.
All right. Well, we wish you luck as you wrap up your studies, and congratulations on your graduation. And thanks both
Thank
of you.
You
for talking with us and sharing your insights today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Peter Briggs, director of MSU's Office of International Students and Scholars, and Jing Chui, who is an MSU undergrad student studying supply chain management. The last time you saw a log cabin? Now, if I ask you that question in the 1800s, you wouldn't think twice about it. Log cabins were a key factor in the westward movement, certainly here in Michigan. Come into Virgin Forest, begin chopping those trees down to clear it for your farmland, and use those trees to build your home. Virginia Handy wants to make sure that we do not forget this important piece of our history. She's the editor, secretary, and the treasurer of the Log Cabin Society of Michigan. Virginia, I'm going to bet most of our listeners didn't even know there was a Log Cabin Society of Michigan. What's your mission?
Well, the mission is to continue what we've got started for the sesquicentennial in 1987. And that was a year when history was just thrown wide open. You could do whatever you wanted to do as long as you got together with other people. And they suggested 100 different projects, you know, to start with. And there was no mention of log cabins. And I thought, well, I was just had built one about 7 years before, and I was getting ready to move into it. And I thought, gosh, that would be a great opportunity to do something for the state, you know, because if nobody else is doing it, we should here in Berrien County. And so I decided to jump in myself, and my grandmother would have been so surprised because she was born in a log cabin, and I'm a log cabin descendant.
You're a log, so log cabins are in your blood.
I'm a log cabin descendant and a log cabin builder and a log cabin editor, and then I discovered that log cabins pertain to everything in our whole civilization, and it's just that they're so ubiquitous, they're everywhere, that people don't even see them anymore.
It is something that is still being built today, correct?
Yes, and we're trying to keep it going, but every now and then it seems to fade away completely, and you look in the phone book and in the yellow pages for log homes, there's nobody else but the Log Cabin Society of Michigan, and so that made me all the more determined to keep this going beyond the 25 years we've been doing it.
Virginia, why do you think it is so important to preserve log cabins and their history?
Well, because we need this balance in this computer age. You know, everything seems to be the future or now, and it seems to me that we just have to keep the old things going.
Talk to me about when you walk into one of these historic, these old cabins that have seen so many decades, even centuries. What happens when you walk in and sit down and you're just there? What goes through your mind?
Well, it just kind of smells old. It's just a different atmosphere altogether and a different air. And, of course, if there's a wood-burning stove, it's really nice in the fall. In the winter, when we have our meetings, our annual meetings at the Bad Axe Pioneer Log Village, our Vice President Cliff Willett has the old potbelly stove going, and it smells so wonderful. It just, the material objects are so different in a fighting log cabin than what we have now. It's a place where you can, I don't know, you just feel transported to a different world.
What is it about that world that draws you so much into it? I can tell your passion for things from the past.
Yeah, well, it takes me back to my childhood where I grew up in a centennial farm that was built by a Civil War veteran after he came back from the Civil War. And I had a lot of old 1800s books, and my grandmother went to Albion. She had old Victorian books of Tennyson and Longfellow and Shakespeare and Elizabeth Barrett Browning. And I was reading, you know, Francis Bacon and Emerson, trying to make sense out of it when I was very young. And I had my great-grandmother's brother was the sheriff of Berrien County in the 1890s. And my great-great-uncle, Rock Edwards, Civil War things. And, you know, that was the world I preferred.
What do you think that we in 2012 could learn from those pioneers who so painstakingly built those log cabins?
Well, I think it's the value of work, the value of labor. Those people had to work so hard. Everybody had to work, you know. And I remember reading about President Garfield. When father died, his mother even did split rails to make her split rail fence. And there was plenty of work to do. I was always busy making things with my hands. and I always had doilies and things that I was crocheting, and the pioneers had to make everything themselves, you know, and you were always having to make everything from scratch. And I think that's what it is when you, all these things about back to the land, that really appeals to a lot of people.
Well, thanks for sharing with us, Virginia Handy, who is the editor, secretary, and treasurer of the Log Cabin Society of Michigan. Thank you, Virginia.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We look forward to connecting with you, and it's easy. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. Go to Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Please get in touch, offer up your comments, suggest stories, or suggest people you think we should profile here on Stateside. Coming up next, you think there's nothing left to say about Detroit? You thought wrong. We'll talk with the author of the new book, Detroit City is the Place to Be. This is Michigan Radio, and you're listening to Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There has been no shortage of media attention focused on Detroit in recent years. As the Detroit auto industry teetered on the brink of extinction in 2008, the big news outlets and the major networks dispatched writers, photographers, and reporters to Detroit. Time magazine even bought a house in Detroit and embedded a team of reporters to cover what appeared to be a disintegrating auto industry and a disintegrating city. Rarely were those reports done by people who had grown up in Detroit or the Tri-County area, Metro Detroit. Rolling Stone writer Mark Benelli did. He grew up in St. Clair Shores. And although his writing career has taken him to New York City, he has plenty of ties to Detroit. And that makes his new book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, the afterlife of an American metropolis so packed with perspective and with insight. Mark Benelli joins us now in the studio. Good to have you here, Mark.
Thanks so much for having me.
I have to say, I devoured your book, and I'm a lifelong Metro Detroiter. I grew up in Ferndale. I live in Oakland County. And there was my first inclination was to think, well, what is he going to say that I don't already know? But you really tell us Detroit's story of its rise and fall with a lot of humor and a lot of heart. What led you to just tackle this project in the first place?
Well, thanks so much for saying that. First of all, it's great to hear from a fellow native Michigander. I guess I started, the book came out of an assignment for Rolling Stone. In 2009, I was sent here to cover the auto show, and you well remember, I'm sure.
It was a grim one.
It was a very dire time. Chrysler and GM were on the verge of bankruptcy. The mayor was in jail. And Detroit had sort of become the poster city of the recession, essentially. Reporters were coming not only from all over the country, but all over the world.
True.
To photograph our ruins and, make Detroit a metaphor for something, some sort of metaphor for the recession. And I felt like as a native, I could, bring a little bit more nuance to the story. Things like I'm really glad you mentioned humor, because I think that's something that's really doesn't come out in a lot of reporting about Detroit. It's always the grimmest.
It's all apocalyptic.
Yeah.
When
in fact, Detroit is, again, as you know, it's a really weird, funny place. And, they're filled with characters. And so, I wanted to sort of present the sort of spectrum of Detroit. It's not just the Detroit that people often see.
You give us a very clear picture of Detroit as a post-industrial frontier. And when you think about our history and the westward movement and the frontier, it meant opportunity, not necessarily destruction and gloom and doom. Is that what you've discovered as you're getting to get a sense of Detroit in 2012?
I'd say so. I end the book on a note of sort of cautious optimism. I mean, there's definitely such a long list of problems the city faces that that seem difficult to imagine how they'll be overcome. But one of the things that made me feel optimistic was exactly that sense of sort of bottom-up potential. And by that, I mean I have a chapter in the book called DIY Detroit. There's sort of a do-it-yourself possibility in a city like Detroit, which is for all intents and purposes, a failed state. I mean, a lot of the city just does not have a functioning government. The one upside of that, though, is it opens things up in a weird way. So you can there's lots of stuff happening on a micro level that is very exciting. Things like the urban gardening gets written about a lot, mm-hmm. and that's basically people taking something that, you know, is negative. All these houses are gone, all this empty space, mm-hmm. and turning it into an asset. You know, growing food there and feeding a community that is sort of underserviced.
Very much so, yes.
You know, I found a whole range of things happening along those lines, from people throwing blues concerts, you know, these sort of DIY blues concerts out in the middle of these blasted out neighborhoods, to, of course, the artists who get written up a lot, mm-hmm. And just, you know, entrepreneurs in general who can snatch up really cheap real estate and turn it into maybe try to do something that they wouldn't be able to do in a healthier city.
You spend time in the book talking about that uptick of especially younger white residents moving back in the city. You're talking about some of the neighbors you have in your area where you live near Eastern Market. What I found intriguing was the response or the reaction of the black residents who can't get over these young white people rollerblading and walking. Talk a little about that psychology of fear that they've lived under, and they can't get over the white residents.
Yeah, you're talking about one specific yeah. person I interviewed, and I don't want to sort of paint that broad of a brush, but it's an interesting
observation.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think, you know, there are sort of tensions in both directions, mm-hmm. right? As the suburbs get more diverse, there'll be tensions there. Mm-hmm. But the same thing is happening in the city with these, you know, hipsters coming into places like Corktown. And one longtime, lifelong black Detroit resident I was hanging out with, we were driving around one day, and she saw these two kids with beards, you know, the white kids with beards, sort of just standing on a corner. And she had this whole great monologue about, you know, how white people can move into a neighborhood and they throw their windows open, they take the bars off, and, you know, they're rollerblading around, and they've got chickens in the backyard, and she had a great riff about this idea of the psychology of fear. Mm-hmm. Like, do people like that coming from presumably a more privileged background bring with them the expectation of police protection? Like, the police will come if they call the cops, if there are problems.
Which,
like,
I'm sure she did not have.
She also pointed out things like, you know, so-called urban explorers, like kids, you know, and not just kids, adults, mm-hmm. going into abandoned factories and building and taking photos. She sort of pointed out that if you're, you know, some white kid from the suburbs doing that and you get caught, you'll probably just be sent home. If you're, you know, black kids from Detroit would probably receive a sterner reception if they were caught. So that's all interesting.
Mark Benelli, I want to get your take, if I can, on some topics and personalities that you explore in your book, just to give people kind of a sense of what you've learned and what you tell. The big three automakers and the auto bailout.
That was interesting because, as I said, you know, I arrived initially
yes.
to do that story. And weirdly, I mean, I got there in January 2009. 3 days later, I was watching President Obama's inauguration from the Anchor Bar in Detroit, mm-hmm. if people know that bar.
Yeah.
And so the book, even though I didn't intend it to fit this way, it became a sort of snapshot of President Obama's first term, basically from ground zero of the recession. And it was interesting to watch this last campaign unfold and the way in which the president made the auto bailout the centerpiece of his campaign. And,
yes.
you know, I think rightfully so. It was a signature accomplishment. I would also say, though, that it reminded me in certain ways of the bank bailout in that it was a transfer of taxpayer money to these huge multinational corporations. And not enough of the upside seemed to be trickling down to regular people. I mean, it definitely made these companies profitable again. People in places like Michigan and Detroit and in Ohio, rather, who now have jobs mm-hmm. again, are very grateful, of course. But these new jobs are half.
Not paying as much.
It's yeah. basically half of what, you know, starting jobs were mm-hmm. pre-bailout. So they're not the sorts of jobs that made Detroit great once upon a time. And so it's complicated. You know, could more have been squeezed out of the companies? I'm not sure. Yeah. But
Kwame Kilpatrick.
he's a character. So funnily enough, with Kilpatrick, I had actually spent some time with him way back in 2002 for a an article in Rolling Stone that never ended up running, but at the time, he was loved by everyone. I remind people in the book that this was right around the time Chris Rock was mm-hmm. making a movie called Head of State, where he was playing the first black president.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
And he, in interviews, said he was modeling his character not after Obama, who nobody, I think, even knew at the time.
Sure.
But after Kwame Kilpatrick. He was a loved figure. I mean, I traveled. I spent a couple of days with him. We went to some sort of Chamber of Commerce thing in Grand Rapids, which is not necessarily very friendly to Democrats. And people loved him. I mean, he just charmed the crowd. He was the keynote speaker. And then the next day, I went with him, and he spoke at a Baptist church in Detroit, all black Baptist preachers. Mm-hmm. Again, they loved him. But he was just speaking to him one-on-one, brilliant, charismatic. But you could see the seeds of the troubles that mm-hmm. would become his undoing. I mean, the night ended. It was Angels Night. So I was going out on patrol with him. The night ended with the guys around him were going back to the mayoral mansion, which was under construction at the time, to get massages. It was midnight, I think, 12:30. His wife was somewhere else. They were speaking about this right in front of me, which I was like, huh, that's how credulous should I pretend to be? But, it was interesting. Yeah.
Coleman Young.
Coleman Young, he was, growing up in the 70s in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. I mean, in my mind, my memory of him sits side by side with the Ayatollah Khomeini, just in the way that they were both these demonized figures from my childhood who I was too young to really understand
sure.
what was going on, but just the way they were spoken about by adults. And so really studying up on his legacy and reading about him, and particularly reading his autobiography, Hard Stuff, which is so funny and entertaining and profane as he was. I kind of fell in love with him as a historical figure. And I mean, one of the problems with this writing this book was just making it a reasonable length and not,
seven volumes,
seven chapters on Coleman Young alone, which
sure.
you could do. I hope somebody is working on a serious biography of Coleman Young, because that's really such an amazing story, and his life covered so many interesting periods of 20th century American history.
And he certainly was a lightning rod
yeah.
of controversy.
Yes.
The sheer size of the vacant land in Detroit, the urban prairie. You talk a lot about that in your book.
Yeah, I mean, it's somewhere between 30 and 40 square miles, so that's like Paris, basically.
It's like Paris.
Wow. San Francisco.
Sure,
So, yeah, that's the big question. What do you do with that? And another reason to be excited, I think, about the future of Detroit is are these right-sizing initiatives, this talk of moving people into denser urban cores mm-hmm. and doing creative things with the vacant land, farms, mm-hmm. green space, all manner of things. I mean, you see some of these renderings of Detroit in 2020 or 2030, and it's so exciting. But of course, you need money to do these things. And that's where the pessimism comes in. I mean, with the city on the verge of bankruptcy, it won't be cheap.
We're talking with author Mark Benelli. His book, Detroit City is the Place to Be, The Afterlife of an American Metropolis. Mark, you talk about the interesting characters you meet, and I want to have you just tell us a little about that weekly blues concert that you went to, put on by a relative of Joe Louis. And I love the guy you met, one of the bikers, and here's his quote, "They call me Satan, but my name is Joe." Tell me a little about getting past the initial looking at someone and just pigeonholing them into, well, that's what this guy's mm-hmm. like. You learned a lot.
Yeah, I think Detroit, it's really important to just start talking to people, because you're perpetually surprised. I mean, you mentioned the guy putting on the concert,
yeah.
Who's this sort of older guy, retired auto worker, and this sort of goes back to your last question, too. What do you do with all this vacant space?
Yeah.
This is a neighborhood on the east side that used to be tightly packed residential neighborhood, people working at the Pole Town plant primarily. And now most of those houses are gone. It's the type of neighborhood where you'll see one or two houses on a block, and the rest is literally a field with grass that will, come up to your waist. This guy, Pete Barrow, saw this happening. ended up just basically taking over a few of the fields himself, mowing the grass, setting up this kind of crude stage built out of some pallets, and started hosting these weekly blues concerts. And they're packed. I mean, people just come and you feel like you're in Mississippi or something. I mean, it's this
very organic,
really amazing scene. And talking to him, yeah, he just sort of very casually at the end of the conversation just mentioned his cousin Joe Louis, and I said, "What? Yeah, that's you're burying that at the end?" And that wasn't even a big deal to him. He just kind of like sort of, it was just an aside. So that was funny. And then this guy Satan, yeah, I noticed there were a lot of bikers at the show, at the blues show I went to, and so I don't know. He was the most interesting looking one. He had sort of an interesting looking beard and a lot of tattoos, and I chit-chatted with him, and it turned out, yeah, he said his name was Satan. I was like, okay, this is going to be interesting. But then it turned out his job before, he got hurt in a motorcycle accident, so he wasn't doing this anymore, but he used to dive and do underwater work on like oil rigs or something. So really, really interesting, complicated life. He'd been a cop at one point. So yeah, Detroit really rewards you. I mean, particularly as a writer, if you're willing to kind of just get out there and strike up a conversation with people. I mean, some of the best characters in the book are just people I randomly met. I mean, of course, I went the sort of more traditional route too, and I interviewed Mayor Bing and I interviewed the chief of police.
Sure.
And I, you know, but I really, my favorite characters in the book are just random people.
The title is Detroit City is the Place to Be. Why'd you pick that title?
Well, it's from an old Ted Nugent song,
yep.
Which was appealing. The main reason was because it's about this moment in time, beginning around 2009, when Detroit achieved this weird sort of trendiness, you know, for, you know, in good and bad ways. You know, there were people coming to sort of gawk at the ruins. There were people who'd never been to Detroit, who were, you know, eating up these stories about Detroit to make themselves feel better about their own city. But then there's a sort of oddly positive aspect to being branded the worst city in the country, I think. And that is, you know, people will pay more attention to you. And the sorts of people who think about cities have been paying special attention to Detroit because it's, as a friend told me, and I quote her in the book, it's sort of like the unsolvable math problem for urban planning types. So if you can fix Detroit, you can fix Scranton, you can fix Stockton, that won't be a problem. So it's an exciting time here.
Mark, what are your thoughts of what might become of Detroit, let's say, in 20 years?
It's really hard to say, you know. I mean, I the book is, we've just been discussing, it's not really a policy book. It's more like a snapshot of this moment in time. So, I mean, you know, I would hope that some of these plans to sort of change the shape of the city could come to pass. I mean, that would be really exciting. Another thing that I think has been positive has been the way the economy seems to be diversifying. I mean, historically, Detroit has all been all about cars, cars, cars. Mm-hmm. Now you really are seeing, particularly downtown, with the sorts of things Dan Gilbert is doing, people like him, more tech companies, more just sort of general entrepreneurial hubs. So I would think probably the future would be not holding out for GM opening a plant that employs 5,000 people, but maybe 50 people opening small businesses that employ, you know, 50 people each or something like that.
Sure.
So that kind of stuff and hopefully more regional cooperation. I mean, I think that would be the other thing that I would think people would finally wise up about and realize, you know, if there could be more resource sharing, there could be lots done if people work together.
The book is Detroit City is the Place to Be, The Afterlife of an American Metropolis, out from Metropolitan Books. And we've been talking with Mark Benelli, the author. Mark, thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It was great.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Ellen Cortesoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow at 3:00.